Welcome to LOA Today. I'm Walt Thiessen here with life coach Joel Elston, and this is your daily dose of happy. We are so happy you decided to join us today, and I'm so excited to have Joel back because Joel was my first regular co-host starting back around 2014 after he'd done a guest appearance in 2012. And we did it for a few years and it was fun. It was weekly and so forth. And then I had to kind of add to it because I was getting addicted. You know, I started doing it weekly and he did it with me for a while, even after that. And it was a break and then he came back. And then I had to change the schedule so drastically, he couldn't even do it with me anymore, which was a real drag. It was, let me tell you, when you get close to a guy and you've been talking to him and you know him and he knows you, you know, it doesn't feel the same anymore. So it's good to have you back, even if it's for a day, Joel. I love it. How you doing?
I love it. I love it when I'm able to, when you reach out and the universe allows us to talk that day. I was excited this morning. I remember very fondly all those shows we did together. And in the early days, it might have been just me and you listening, but it was still incredibly fun. And very fond memory. So it's always good to, we stay loosely connected via Facebook, but it's always great to be able to talk to you face to face again. So thank you for the opportunity.
Oh, hey, thanks for joining me. I really appreciate it. For people who are curious, Monique is, she's in Houston. So she's dealing with those, rolling blackouts that people in Texas are dealing with because of the storm, but she'll be back next week. We did, give her the encouragement to stay warm and she's doing what she can to do that. But, she'll be back next week. And Joel, you'll remember Cindy Chavez, who also had done the Wednesday podcast. She's doing a bit of a sabbatical right now, but we're expecting her back around, I don't know, end of March, early April, something like that. So a little bit of flux going on, but that's okay. And the flux is a good thing because it brought you in, you know, that's the way this kind of thing works.
Well, it's all perspective, Walt. Let's see how I feel at the end of the show. Okay, let's just.
I think I can predict that one. Actually, I don't think we ever had a show where we felt bad at the end of it. So that was fairly safe prediction.
Yeah.
One of the things I wanted to bring up today to talk about was, of course, we've been going through this pandemic, this COVID pandemic, and over the last about 4 months or so, there's been a huge spike in cases and a lot of fear and so forth. A lot of other crazy stuff has been going on too. But in the last few weeks, it's been plummeting. The number of cases has been plummeting pretty significantly to the point where even the scary to death news media are noticing, which is something. It takes a lot for them to notice some good news. They're trying to find all different ways to discount why it's actually happening, of course. But nevertheless, it's happening. And I just wanted to share some of the reasons they're giving and then kind of get your sense of what you think is going on. I want to give my sense of what I think is going on because I think there's something to what they're saying, but I think they're missing a key factor. So let's see what you have to say. So here's what they're saying. They're saying there are four things, and this kind of varies from article to article depending on what you read, but there are four things that are driving it. They say that people are doing more social distancing and more mask wearing, which I'm kind of dubious about. They say, well, it's because spring is coming. Okay, well, that's an interesting medical reason. I hadn't heard of that one before, but okay. They said that 15 to 30% of the population have already had it or been exposed to it. Okay, well, I can kind of, you know, get into that one. And they're also saying, well, yeah, there's also, you know, there's a small percentage, I guess roughly 4% of the population has had full vaccine, roughly 11, 12% have had half the vaccine. You know, and they're saying, okay, well, it's going to have a little bit of effect on it. I think it probably has more of an effect that they're giving credit for. But what do you think? What's your take on what's happening here? I want your take before I give mine.
Well, it's funny because one of my rituals in life is I listen to I'm an adamant listener of Abraham Hicks, and every day for the last couple of months, I've just been rotating between the law of attraction, asking is given, and you know, the law of attraction and money. I've sort of been rotating those books. So today, she was addressing basically this.
Right.
There's a multiple factors, some political that I won't even get into, but there's multiple factors involved that when we give attention to something, we attract it. That's basic law of attraction. That is.
Right.
But especially when things are awfulized or taken to the extreme, we're given our extreme attention to. So it's been driven that way. One of the things I given in that, I talked about the show a long time ago when I first moved to the Richmond area. I don't normally watch local news, but I was watching the local news just to get a flavor of what was going on. And, you know, about 4:58, they came on with this, you know, lady standing in front of her house that had just burned down and said, you know, breaking news, a house in South Richmond has burned to the ground. The family loses everything. Stay tuned. And so, you know, the first right at 5 o'clock, they go right to her. And I really like this lady immediately. The reporter was, ma'am, your house just burned to the ground. You lost everything you owned, all your possessions. And she said, well, that's true, but my kids got out safe. Even the dog got out safe. We have insurance. We're going to be fine. We're staying with neighbors tonight. Well, ma'am, how did it feel to lose everything, including pictures of your children? And she's like, well, they're all backed up on, you know, I have them stored in the cloud. We're good. You know, I have all availability, all that. You know, I'm more focused on it. And then the third time he went back to, well, did you think that you could have lost your children? And this is live TV. And she goes, sir, are you trying to get me to cry? You try. You know, I'm not going to see it any differently. Well, it's also the same theory when, I promise you, especially all over the country, but right now in Texas, and you know, my thoughts to those out there that are going through everything you're going through right now. But I promise you, if you were to look at the Weather Channel's ratings right now, they're quadruple what they were, you know, before the storm started, you know, when things are going, because attention has been, you know, played. It feeds up. Now, first of all, we do need the information, but second, the more attention we pay to stuff, the more we bring back. So those analogies are the media is a form of hypnotherapy. They literally come at you with the worst case scenario. If you remember the earthquakes in California years ago during the World Series, I know you're a baseball fan, so I want to bring in some baseball today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Yeah. It happened in the evening, and when the helicopter was flying over, there was like one car that was on fire, and at night from a heli, it looked like the entire city was on fire with the way they were showing it. In reality, when they pulled way away, it was just a car on fire.
Right.
And, you know, but again, our focus becomes what we're sort of led to. So getting all the way back around to your question with, you know, we attract into our lives what we're believing. When you really believe all of these things, that is when it increases. So I do think, again, some political and just changes in season, not, I don't mean the spring coming, but changes in direction. The media has quit focusing on it so much. We're focused on the new stimulus package, or we're focused on this, or we're focused on impeachment proceedings, or we're focused on all these sideshows. And so maybe it's not as bad. And also, I think a lot of us got to sort of COVID fatigue, as I like to call it. It's like, we after a while, is it really this big bad wolf? And I'm not trying to debate COVID's real. I'm not trying to suggest it's not. But I think the focus that the media leads us to believe, the thing, you know, there was so many things that happened that every day, here's the death count. Here's the, you know, and it would go up. Here's the, and I always, you and I talked about this, I believe last time we talked, I would love for them to have included, here's the recovery count. Here's So as now the vaccine came along, the drama of it all, we don't have, you know, part of the antagonist of, you know, President Trump's world and something he brought to the equation, the media loved picking on him and he loved picking on them. And so this created a lot of it. I think all that has sort of changed. So I believe the biggest factor is our focus has sort of waned and we're sort of moving on to other stuff. And it's still out there. And you know, I do believe the vaccines are going to more of a law of attraction standpoint for the actual than anything else will sort of help. there's a remedy here so we can sort of be okay with it now until the next catastrophe comes along. That's a long answer to your question.
I agree with you. I think I might be inclined to kind of phrase it even more in the positive, because from the way I'm looking at it, I think people are just feeling more relief and feeling better about the situation.
Sure.
They're just feeling, it's like, oh God, we got through all this craziness that's been going on. Huh, take a breath. And just in that action alone, you get into what we call the higher vibe place, which they're not doing it deliberately. It's not like most people understand how vibration works or, you know, the conscious creation or law of attraction or all that stuff we talk about, but they're getting there by default, by accident, by, you know, just circumstance. And it's producing a result. And it's pretty dramatic. I mean, I was looking at the curves that are, you know, you can go to websites that are drawing curves based on all the data that's out there. And the curve is fairly substantial right now. It's a very steep downward slope that we're on. In fact, I was looking, obviously I live in Connecticut, so I was curious what was going on in Connecticut. Connecticut has our lowest numbers since like last August. I mean, wow. Really big drop. And that's not necessarily true for the entire country, but across the country, I think right now, the numbers, for instance, from yesterday were equivalent to like late September, you know, so it's a substantial drop. And at the rate we're going, I've been saying pretty much since the thing started, maybe like last summer or something like that, that I thought this thing was going to basically in most people's minds be past. You know, we'll be past most of it. Not that the whole thing will be done, but we'd be past most of it by April 1st of this year. I'm feeling really confident about that prediction now.
I think you're on point with your prediction.
Really, it's like, I think by April 1st, people are going to say, whoa, what happened? They're going to be in shock almost. The news reporters won't know what to do with themselves because, you know, they got to go find a new crisis somewhere.
Oh, they will. Trust me. They will. But that's sort of the biggest part of managing this without sounding like a, you know, total kook to the average person is so much of what we believe is our reality. That's the end of the day stuff. And there are people going to, during the height of COVID, you had people working in grocery stores, admittedly young, healthy people, as you know, I'm an avid weightlifter and an exercise guy. I happened to read a report that the gym transmission within the gym in the United States of COVID was like, I wish I could remember, but it was 0.00 something. It was
really, really small.
It was really small. Just to read, you know, it was almost more likely to catch it outside than it did. And a lot of that goes to because a lot of the gym people in there tend to be very healthy people. Most of them are much more focused on health than illness. And so that there's almost a natural law of attraction barrier. And that doesn't mean, I'm sure there's law of attraction people that have gotten COVID. I'm not suggesting that it's not a possibility.
Sure.
I'm just suggesting that like you're saying, once our focus goes, now there'll be a new thing to focus on. Esther on today's, when I listened to her today, she was talking about, you know, years ago, polio was there. They came with a polio vaccine. They basically got rid of polio. Then, but as she pointed out, then AIDS came along and then, you know, she went through the list of things that just kept coming up. And then they sort of remedied that. Then heart disease came along and heart disease is something as common as it is now was unheard of in 1900. There's always sort of a new, you know, attention to that versus attention to the health. And that's a really important factor that one of the, I wear a mask. I wash my hands. I do the things I should be doing, but also within the same spectrum of that, I don't walk around daily. I'm in incredible health. I feel wonderful. And I expect that to continue. And I think as people have sort of relaxed, you know, I'm not fearing that. I'm not drawing my attention, the fear that's happening versus, okay. And I probably know 20 people that have had it like pretty well, like, you know, good friends, and 20 people while certainly said, yeah, it's like most described it from the, this is my, you know, what they told me, somewhere between the cold and a flu.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's a lot as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I know two personally. So, you know, 20, like, oh, wow. Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So, I mean, but also I have a huge network of people.
You do. You know about 500,000 more people than I do. So it makes sense.
Probably every day. But I certainly, you know, I'm so glad that it is going down. I think if it gets reported even more without necessarily they're trying to come up with their explanations, then just as like we were driving it up with our fear of it, I think we continue to drive it down with our relief from it too.
Mm-hmm. I think so. And I'm going to be kind of curious to see what the numbers are next week, because next week represents 2 weeks after the Super Bowl. And they were writing 2 weeks ago about how there was going to be a Super Bowl super spreader with everybody getting together to watch the Super Bowl. And I have a feeling that's not going to be there, but we're going to have to see, wait to see what happens. I'm going to hold out hope that it's not there just because I don't want people to get sick, but I think it's a very good chance of that. We'll see.
Well, we'll see. I'm hoping we're able to, like, I hope your prediction of April 1st is where we're basically considered, other than a few stragglers, you know, sort of wrapping this up. I hope we're in a really good place.
Yeah, I don't think, the medical leaders, the government leaders and so forth are going to say it's all done by April 1st.
No, I'm not suggesting.
I mean, because they've made it very clear they aren't going to think it's going to be under control until July, August at the earliest. So
well,
I think we can assume they're going to follow through on that plan.
Well, I have several doctor friends that believe that this will sort of eventually be wrapped into sort of the flu concept, and that it's going to be every year certain number of people get it, and you know it'll just be part of a type of flu.
Yeah, well, they'll probably include it in the flu shots that they give everybody.
Well, that's the ultimate goal. We're having the granddaddy shot of all, and you know you just add that to the flu shot, and
right.
So that's probably where it's going.
Yeah. Okay. So interesting. Not surprising. We're on the very same track. They're very similar track. Got another question for you. And this actually ties into, I was telling you before we got started about how I'm kind of venturing into the public speaking realm. And I've been doing a lot of the prep work, getting ready to do it. Now I've been reaching out to schools and eventually companies and, you know, sales forces and all that kind of stuff to try to find speaking gigs. But in the course of doing that, I'm also spending time developing my talk. I've been talking about that quite a bit here on the show. Key portions of my talk are about aiming at college students, as I told you before the show, and as listeners know, simply because of the amount of what the statistics are showing that college students are going through in terms of the stresses and pressures and anxieties that they're dealing with on a daily basis. In fact, as part of my research that I was doing and prepping my first talk, I found a paper. It's part of the National College Health Assessment that gets done every year, interviewing college students to find out where they're at on all ranges of health, including mental health. And I'm actually drawing from two different assessments, the 2020 assessment and the 2019 assessment. The 2020 was actually released just as COVID was coming into play. So COVID really was not included in those numbers. But even so, I added up all the people who reported some kind of mental health issue during that time frame, which was leading up to that date in spring 2020. 98.4% of college students reporting experiencing moderate to severe stress during the previous 12 months. So basically everyone, except for like 1% of them. And then the 2020 didn't break it down as much. The 2019 report broke it down pretty significantly. Let me just read some of these numbers to you because they're just kind of staggering. 87% report feeling overwhelmed by all they had to do. 85% reported feeling exhausted, but not from physical activity. 56% reported feeling that things were hopeless. 66% reported that they felt very lonely. 71% reported feeling very sad. 45% reported feeling so depressed that it was difficult to function. I mean, these are just unbelievable. 43% overwhelming anger that they're feeling. 66% overwhelming anxiety. And yet 2/3 of the students report never seeking professional help, despite the fact that compared to when you and I were in school, there's tremendous numbers of options that are available to them today. And I guess I can't say I'm really surprised that only 1/3 are taking advantage of it, but those numbers really caught my attention. They were one of the main reasons why I decided to orient my talk the way that I did. And I specifically want to focus in on one of them, the one that said that 66% are very lonely. And I saw another report that said that, and this is among college students, so that's basically what we call the Gen Z, you know, they're the ones after the millennials. 79% report just being lonely, 66% very lonely. So it's a pretty substantial loneliness thing. And loneliness generally being defined as either not being in an intimate relationship or not having close friends. In fact, 1/5 of Gen Zs are reported to have no friendships at all going on, other than, you know, Instagram friend type things. And I'm thinking that really is substantial. They documented that it's a very big increase compared to prior generations. And so first I wanted to get your take on that. What do you think is going on there? And second, I just wanted to get some ideas from you and share some ideas about what can be done about that. Cause it ties in directly with what my talk is. And I'm always looking for ideas to add to my talk. So this is like a 2-piece thing here. This is do a show and get some information out of Joel for the talk, you know?
Well, I always appreciate the spontaneity of how you and I do this. I really do. I love you throwing something at me and this is great. and I'm sincere. I really do. This is the best way I do stuff. I think in your description, you mentioned a portion of it. I look at what is different between when you and I were in college and what's going on right now. I'm looking at the number one factor. Now there's sub factors within this, but the virtual world, the internet world, the social media world, young people are developing different types of relationships than we did. Mm-hmm. I even look to, I have a son that is home. He's 15. When I was 15, every Friday night, we would all go to the local mall. We'd see a movie. We would chase girls. We'd play around and, you know, sometimes it was a little wild, but nonetheless, we did that every Friday night. We had to learn how to get along. There were some fights. There was, there's normal working it out. None of them go, very few of them go out like that anymore. Gatherings don't exist anymore. My son on a Friday night is there. He's playing, you know, on his Xbox. Their phone. They're talking through the Xbox. He has a group of quote unquote friends. I know them, all nice young men, but the intimate connections, they're missing the piece of that. So I think the groundwork has been laid for years now by allowing the virtual world to become a replacement for our reality. And that on one side, I believe that's the conduit that led to it. Then on top of that, I also, I think the subcategory, because they're at home, they're sitting around, they're not exercising, they're not as active as they used to be. I think that's a factor that leads to the feeling of, you know, exercise, even though it is exhausting, it does clear mental, the mental fatigue. So exercise actually gives you more energy. They're not getting near the exercise they used to get. Exercise, produces a lot of anti-depression chemicals, sure, anti-anxiety chemicals, that take place in the brain. So as you sort of chop down, you know, all of this angle, plus there's a focus on, you know, you'll hear a lot about doctors, I think it was 2017 is the last data. 294 million prescriptions were written for antidepressants in the United States.
Wow. Wow. Oh,
it's a mind boggling number.
It is.
And not even to get into my rant about antidepressants, there is a percentage of the population that certainly need and benefit from such drugs. Mm-hmm. However, that percentage is somewhere between 1 to 2% at most of the population.
Mm, yeah.
Probably a little lower than that. But yet almost enough prescriptions are written for every single human in the living in the United States. So,
yeah.
So there's an influence on, you know, there's sort of a suggestion. Well, you're depressed. You're this. There's a label. I had a 12-year-old in my office yesterday. I said, tell me what's wrong with you. He goes, well, I'm depressed. I go, where did you hear that? Where did that? Somebody told a 12-year-old he was depressed and he believes he's depressed. And he's not. After we got done with it, I said, your situation is not optimal and you're not performing. And we went through the reasons why, but he has a narrative that started when he was about 11 years old that he is depressed and he has four or five other diagnoses. I forget he's spouting out there. And I'm like, none of these are true. So there's a lot of factors. It's similar to, you know, COVID going up and down. A lot of emphasis is placed on, oh, well, you're clearly depressed or you're clearly this, you're clearly that. And the reality is not necessarily All these people are not depressed, and there's people that aren't living up to their potential. The lack of connectivity that when I do very few online meetings. I much prefer in person when I'm meeting with clients. The main reason is I believe that interconnectivity, that you pick up energy, we pick up energy, we're in the same room with people. There's an energy. Now, I think our energy can go over the virtual line.
Sure.
It's a really good connection. But in general, I find a better connection in person with people. So, when I'm with somebody, you're not connecting and you're not sharing energy. You're not sharing ideas. You're not discussing things. So you feel disconnected and lonely. Then you go full circle and you start looking at everybody else's pretend life that is on Amazon, on Instagram or Facebook or whatever you're doing. And wow, they're out skiing with their friends and they're having a party. And I'm sitting here at home. Well, the truth is they're staging those photos and to make you think they're doing more. And it's this big vicious circle of what we have going on. And so it's a multi-pronged approach, but it starts with where I think you're going to go. I know you well enough. I believe the interconnectivity or the lack thereof, and again, compounded worse by COVID, is what sociologists one day will study of where that sort of turned, because mm-hmm. while we certainly, you know, not to be too descriptive of what took place in our early college years, depressed was generally not the theme.
It wasn't something that I thought about. I think looking right. back, there were times when I was experiencing depression, I just kind of dismissed it. Because I think what I was really feeling, particularly in my freshman year, was powerlessness.
Yes.
I felt very much of a victimhood type mode, and I didn't understand that that's what I was feeling, and I certainly didn't know how to get out of it. In fact, one of the themes that I've been building into my talk is I didn't know what to do. My parents didn't know what to do. They didn't know what to teach me. My teachers, my professors didn't know what to teach me. My peers didn't know what to teach me. The other adults, nobody knew what to teach me. Nobody even knew what the problem was. And if they had known, they still wouldn't have known how to teach me to get out of it. In fact, I also tell stories. I realized I was actually part of four different sales organizations that I completely failed at throughout my younger years. And in every single case, well, in one case, the sales manager who hired me when I floundered, he just never talked to me again. But in the other cases, they tried to help me. They did their best. Now, their best wasn't particularly successful. In fact, it failed utterly. One guy in particular, I had met him out in Oregon, and he had hired me to work for W. Clement Stone's company, combined insurance company. That's the one that he became a billionaire off of and became a success motivational speaker off of. I was working for that company, and Jerry tried so hard. He worked with me almost like every other day, trying to find ways to help me get motivated and help me feel good and all that kind of stuff. But he couldn't do it. He couldn't get me there. And I don't think he understood what it was that had to be done. That's why I remember asking him one time, why is it that you feel so good about this and I feel so bad? He says, I have no idea. I can't tell you. I just don't know. I wish I did. I wasn't the only one. He had hired a group of about, I don't know, 12 of us in that group of hiring. All of us flamed out. Every single one of us. He really desperately wanted us to find a way to at least one or two of us to survive. I actually did better than the others. I sold more than the others did, but I flamed out the last, and I was there the longest. I was there about 8 months, but I flamed out too. And it was simply because none of them, including Jerry, knew what was going on and knew what to do about it. And it's taken me a lifetime to figure it all out, including doing the show for 8+ years. And I finally came to what I think my conclusion about what it is really all about, that it's about lack of self-love or not lack of, but inadequate self-love, because we all love ourselves. We just don't necessarily love ourselves enough, and inadequate social connections. And when I look at my own life at that time, that describes me to a T. I had very few close friendships. I had a decent family connection, but it's not like we were talking every day, you know, maybe, you know, once or twice a month, that kind of a thing. I didn't have the social connections to fall back on when I needed them. And I wouldn't have known what to do even if I had them, because I never knew the importance of developing them. And right. I never really understood what it takes to build self-love. I never even knew about the concept of self-love. It didn't even occur to me. It wasn't part of the conversation at that particular time. And I draw from what the positive psychology movement, which has sprouted up over the last 20, 25 years, has discovered through their research. Social connections actually is their biggest metric. They want to be able to predict whether some person is going to be successful in their life. All they have to do is look at the social connections, look at the breadth of them and the depth of them. You were talking about the depth of them when you were talking about, you know, going out with the friends on Friday and so forth. That combination, that tells them 70% of the time whether or not the person's going to be successful with accuracy.
Wow. Now,
it's not 100%, but one of the comparators that I saw was it's still pretty good because if you look, for instance, at the correlation between smoking cigarettes and getting cancer, that's 44%. So it's almost double that correlation. It's a right. pretty strong correlation. It doesn't cover everything, though. And so I've been trying to ask myself, how do you account for the other 30%? What does the other 30% need? And that's where I started kind of getting in on the idea, well, what about the self-love piece? Now, the research shows us that self-love, building self-love by itself doesn't actually improve the ability of a person to do the task or to do whatever it is they're doing. What it does do, and I thought this was really fascinating, it increases their ability to persevere on it, to keep going when adversity hits. And so I started to realize there's a dynamic that goes on when you combine the two factors together. On the one hand, if you have the social connections, in breadth and in depth, so there's quite a few of them and they're deep connections, then when you stumble and fall, one or more of those people is going to be available to help you. Whereas if you have only one or two or none, but if you have only one or two, then it's, well, is that person available at the particular time that you need them? Maybe not, you know. So having that breadth of connectivity helps because at any given time when you're stumbling, there's somebody there you can reach out to that you know at that particular time of day, on that particular day of the week and so forth. That person probably is going to be able to reach, you're going to be able to reach them. Or if that person isn't there, there's another person who's very similar who could also help you out. And that's where you actually get the ability to pick yourself up again because you have somebody who helps you to do it. And then if you're also building up the self-love, that gives you the desire to persevere. Well, I've been applying both of those concepts. First, one of them by accident, just by doing this podcast. I mean, we were doing it at first on a weekly basis. And then you'll remember I got to the point where it wasn't enough. I had to do it more often because I was enjoying it so much. So I started to do it daily. And I thought I was just doing it daily just because it was fun and because I would learn a whole lot more. What I didn't realize is I was inadvertently increasing the breadth and depth of my social connections because
wow.
I'm good friends with all my co-hosts.
Right.
And I mean, they're all virtual. I don't meet physically with any of you guys, but I get to know all of you really well and you get to know me really, really well. It's almost as good as having that in-person friendship. And it's been really sustaining me in ways that I hadn't thought of. And of course, being a law of attraction show, we talk about that a lot. So I'm always looking for ways to get into that high vibe space. That's all about building self-love, you know, so I'm doing both at the same time. And I'm finding, like I told you, I'm getting this speaking career going. I'm at the stage now where I normally would run into a wall and crack up and stop because it involves sales. I have this thing about sales that had built up over the years. And I'm finding that, yeah, I run into those days where I just hit the wall and just feels terrible, but I'm able to climb out of it now. Why? Because I have a social connection every day when I'm doing the show. And this work I've been doing with, you know, building self-love, I now have these little processes that I can do, mirror exercises and affirmations and all this stuff. I go back and do them. It just picks me right back up again. The two together really become quite a dynamic. So that's why they become the basis for my talk.
I love that. And,
yeah.
You know, the sort of from a neuroscience standpoint, the inner dialogue that we all have or most people have an inner dialogue. Mm-hmm. And that takes place mainly from our subconscious thoughts. Mm-hmm. And our subconscious thoughts have been programmed for 50, 60, 70 years for some of us. And every single thing gets stored subconsciously. Your subconscious brain operates at 40 million bytes per second.
Is that high? I heard 11. Yeah. So that's even better.
Yeah. Yeah. The conscious brain is 40,000. So
oh, okay.
your, Yeah. So you don't, and we don't have direct access to the subconscious brain. So okay. This dialogue, remember Muzak used to be in the elevators?
Oh, God,
this,
yes.
This dialogue is the Muzak in our brain that just plays us over and over. You're not worthy. You're not this. You're not that. And it's this, that while we do have, and you know, you got your mom and dad, oh, you're great. You're awesome. But yet there's nothing supporting that. So right. What you've uncovered from the practical application is how to begin the process of you reprogram the subconscious brain by doing what you're doing. You surround yourself with different energy. You start changing your thought patterns. Why positive psychology or law of attraction works so well, it is in hypnotherapy, which I'm really into as well. Hypnotherapy will get access to the subconscious brain quicker. You mm-hmm. change that dialogue, then your self-esteem rises, your self-love rises, and then you start to see things from a different perspective. Because no matter how hard you try, since the law of attraction responds to how you're feeling, and your feelings are usually emanating from the thoughts that are taking place in your subconscious brain. Did that make mm-hmm. any sense?
Yes,
so,
sure.
So when you, that vibration I was talking about with the interconnectivity or that deep connection with people, that is another conduit that raises your vibration that doesn't require help from your subconscious brain. That'll override it. That's why, years ago when I would in the middle of an addictive spiral with a crazy world I was going into, I'd lost everything. I had nothing. There was nowhere to go. And I was sitting in my home one night and with no electricity, and it was miserable in Florida. And a friend of mine asked me to come play racquetball. And I'm like, what? I can't. And he just kept bugging me to come play racquetball. I finally said, okay, I'll go play. Whatever if you have depression, I was in despair or whatever is below that. It was just. However, after about an hour of racquetball, I had an entirely different perspective of what was happening.
Wow.
And not only was it the intense physical exercise of racquetball, which I love, it's a great sport, but mm-hmm. also the group of guys we're playing with, I'm not telling them about the problem. We're just talking about life. That connectivity, I didn't sit there and go, yeah, I've gambled all my money away. I'm probably going to jail and I lost my fiance because I sold the engagement ring. I didn't say any of that. Mm-hmm. I just talked. And when we were done, I got home and even the electricity was all out. I cleaned up my apartment. I began the process, and that got me on an upward spiral. So you see that, you know, in what you're talking about with college students, it gets compounded when you go away to college often, when you're removed from the little bit of support you have with your family. And sometimes that support, even though it's good with your family, it's also part of the negative development over the years. Your parents are in protective mode. You know, in their protective mode, they sometimes will say, well, be careful. Don't get your hopes up.
Right.
You're not really good at that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all that gets programmed too. So when you get in college and you're operating for that low self-love, that low vibration, and then you're isolating, you're looking at everybody else that seems to be having fun and all these other things are going on. And then it becomes a refeeding of the dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
That becomes your reality. So, I really, really am a big fan of what you're doing, what you're talking about, because I think this does tie into the law of attraction in a direct way.
Oh, it does. Yeah.
Positive psychology to me is basically the science of the law of attraction. And mm-hmm. it also doesn't get you laughed at on, you know, in
yes,
a lot
right.
of people. Yeah. Yeah. And
that's a benefit. You know,
yeah. So it, you have that. But, you know, when you realize, I've watched you over the years just, you know, go from the patterns of, you know, the old walk pattern is you would have an idea and then you would spend like 7 months researching it to death. I mean, you would mm-hmm. research it from every, you'd send spreadsheets, you'd do this and you'd look yep. at it from this way. And then eventually when it got to the tangible action place, which required some type of sales or other, and this ain't going to work. And then you'd move on to the next one.
Exactly.
You've broken that pattern by and I'm going to say the research was bad, but
no, not at all. It was helpful in many ways.
It was helpful, but because you were good and you enjoyed the research, that was the fun part. When
right.
it required you to ask somebody to basically buy your concept,
Yep.
Whoa. Let's don't do that. Exactly. Let's don't get crazy on that. You're supposed to just want to offer to buy it without me asking kind of thing.
I love that. That's funny.
But I also watched you change that over the years. I remember when you decided to pull the trigger and do multiple shows. That was a joke on our show one time. You made the decision to do it like instantly and versus, well, let's talk about this for about 9 months and see what happens. You did it instantly. And it was,
I believe the concept was known as ready, fire, aim, if I remember correctly.
And so I love that you're taking this concept because it's all does go together. It's exactly what you're saying, but we underestimate the same energy that the law of attraction responds to is, believe it or not, what we respond to. When you're around a group, when you lift yourself up or lift a group up, Napoleon Hill talks about mastermind meetings being a very big factor in when people want to get together. It isn't that we're going to come up with a genius idea. It's the energy of the room that almost meets and then comes up with these fascinating, incredible, brilliant strategies that any one of them could have had, but it was facilitated by the power of that mastermind meeting. So even in his book, he doesn't call it self-love or connectivity, but he gets into this about how, use your networking, get people together, talk about ideas. I've attended and conducted multiple mastermind meetings. I never, ever have been disappointed with some of the stuff. I've seen people totally change their life in one mastermind meeting, but just like, I've never thought of it that way. And they go off on a new idea. It's great.
That's cool. I like that a lot. Hey, you mentioned something else too. And it's something that you and I used to talk about a lot here on the show. I haven't talked about a lot recently because my other co-host didn't have your background and that really played into it. But you mentioned addiction. And I saw a TED talk the other day that I'd never seen before. My sister-in-law, Yoana, pointed me to it. And the guy was making a really interesting point. He was basically telling his story about how he had family members who had addictions, and he wanted to know how he could help them, but he didn't know what to do. And he just started doing some research. He started from the position of, what medical science told him addiction was all about, and came to realize that what they were saying really didn't add up to his experience. And so he started looking deeper and looking for alternatives. Without going through his whole story, the bottom line he came up with at the very end of his talk was he realized that the opposite of addiction is social connection. And I'm wondering, do you agree with that? Do you think that that's completely actually true?
Yeah. Completely. Yeah. That is that's sort of been what I've been doing with addiction for years. I was working at an addiction treatment center when we first spoke. In fact, I believe in using the law of attraction and helping people in recovery from addiction.
Right.
Because it goes together. And by the way, it's my solution for everything. So that too. So,
panaceas are great if they work, So
yeah, exactly. So, but what you're saying is the old narrative when you're dealing with a family member that had addiction is to, the concept of very tough love. You will do this. You'll make them do this. You'll make them. And that distanced the addict often from his only support network. And there is a way to increase connectivity and not put yourself in a position of enabling. Enabling is an entirely separate thing. There's several programs right now. One of my colleagues has developed and runs a very successful, support group for families with that exact concept that you're talking about of connectivity. You still love your family member and there are ways to not enable that, but also still love them no matter where they're at, increase the connectivity, use the previous lifetime. Here's where you were before. Addiction is separation in isolation, not only from peers, but also from your true self. Addiction is it. And so this person, I believe I've seen that same talk. And now the addiction treatment world will argue on parts of that. When you're physically addicted to heroin, that's an entirely, this is a concept. But you, there is a physical addiction that takes place with heroin. I mean, obviously. And so they're, but connectivity is part of the recovery solution as well. And, you know, making, restoring connection, developing connection. You see that being one of the biggest factors. The biggest success, I'm not a big fan of most 12-step meetings, because I think they tend to get very rigid and punitive. However, where they do help is when you've got a group of people supporting each other in a room, there's power in that.
There is.
The room, the people in the room, in my opinion, are the success of 12-step programs. They're supporting each other. They're helping each other. We're there for you. We care about you. Let's try that. That's the, to me, that was the, in my opinion, the only thing that I got out of the 12-step meetings. The 12 steps themselves were sort of weird. They offered me no value. But as far as the rooms, the people in the room were quality, nice, kind people who understood what I was going through and were very supportive. That was the best part of 12-step meetings for me personally. And so I believe addiction is best supported with increasing that connectivity type. And I think you're really on point with your beliefs as well. I mean, that matches.
It certainly matches what the speaker was saying. I think we probably did see the same talk. If I remember correctly, one of the things that he mentioned in there was that the traditional way of handling an addict who's kind of out of control, over the edge, is to do an intervention and basically threaten to take away from him the things that we would normally associate with just, you know, normal life until he gets his act together. And the speaker's point was that's actually counterproductive, which flies in the face of some pretty strong, you know, scientific advocacy, shall we say. I'm curious what you think about that.
Well, it really is. I am very opposed to the traditional intervention style where you hijack the person, you put all their family in the room and say, we're going to cut you off. We're going to cut off connections. You're going to sleep outside. You have no place to be at a low point. That is, I don't do those type interventions. I have done whether it's an intervention or not, I have sat down with someone with his family and say, your family's so concerned about you. They don't know how we're going to be able to do it. Would you consider whether you have the self-esteem and the self-love to do it for yourself? Would you consider getting help, even if it's just for them, and just doing it in a very softer way? The success rate of somebody that voluntarily goes to treatment because they really want it is, I mean, it's so much higher than you will go to treatment. And, you know, there's one interventionist here in the Richmond area that he meets with the family the night before. He has these very hardcore letters written. You will do this or we are kicking you out. You won't have access to your nephews. You won't be able to see us anymore and you'll be separated from the family and cut out of the will. They may get them to treatment with that technique, but the success of the treatment is horrible with that technique. When you lovingly, calmly, you know, collaborate with them to get some kind of help. I know most of the people I deal with, I like to have three options, you know, and whatever those options are, you know, it's, you know, a lot of them, well, I don't want to go to treatment. I don't want to do this. And say, well, let's look at some outpatient work and agree that if that doesn't work, maybe we will look at a higher level of care. Something like that is a much more effective technique than forcing them into a treatment center in California and telling you can't talk to anybody for 30 days. And so you're right. I mean, and with my experience in this, I've been asked to do interventions and I will do it my way or, you know, I won't do it. Because there's plenty of people take the money to do it, but my goal is solely not treatment. It's getting them to a treatment facility with potential of success. Yes. And if they're super angry because their entire family just bailed on them, treatment's not going to be successful anyway.
Right. Yeah. And which so makes sense when you think about that. I mean, I think part of what happens is we hear an expert telling us that we've got to do it this way. And so we almost throw the common sense out the window and say, well, the expert ought to know. He's got to be an expert in this, you know, so we should be listening to him. Yeah. And it's amazing what we're willing to give up to, I guess I'd call it authority. You know, that's an authority figure. They know their stuff. So we'll give up to authority, even though everything inside of us saying this isn't going to work.
I had an interesting case of probably about 5 months ago, a family, a prominent family in Richmond. Their son has a heroin problem, and they had discovered it, and they hired an interventionist to come in. Mm-hmm. And this guy charges $20,000 for the intervention. He's there for 2 days. And the family is to write these letters. A grandmother was going to be there who he loved and adored, and she didn't even know he was using drugs, so she was horrified. Mm. His little sister was going to be there. His best friend was going to be there, and they were going to walk in on a Saturday morning, and he was going to be out of nowhere, going to be in the room with all these people, not allowed to leave, and told that he's either going to treatment or all these people are done with him. And so somewhere along the way, one of their friends, they told him what they were going to do. And their friend said, no, you probably, before you do that, you call Joel.
All right. I like
it. And so they called and they said, they told me what was going to happen. I said, well, I don't think that's a good idea. And they were like, well, you know, everybody else said this other way, but our gut says it's not going to work, but this guy he has this credential and everybody says that that's the way to do it. And I said, well, you know, I'm not being disrespectful, but the success rate of a lot of these places are 10%. So, I mean, I'm not going to get all excited about a 90% failure rate on this technique. And I said, give me your son's number and let me try another way. Mm-hmm. So I called, he didn't answer my call, but I left a message at first. So my name's Joel. Can you give me a call? I have some information for you. I'll only take 10 minutes of your time. So I guess I made him curious enough. He called me. I explained. I said, look, I'm a life coach here in town and also work with people with addiction. I want to give you a heads up. Tomorrow morning, here's what's about to happen.
Oh, my. Wow.
And I told him all of this. And he goes, oh, my God. Oh, my God. That's terrible. And I go, do you have a problem with heroin? He goes, yeah, I probably do. And I said, well, I'll be glad to come over and pick you up. I'll take you to the place and we can avoid all that drama. And we'll just tell your family, thanks for caring and let's get some help. He said, let's do that.
Wow. Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. And last report, he was doing very well. He's on a maintenance drug to help with the cravings long term. And so, I mean, my point is that there's a show intervention that literally shows, and there's a lot of drama attached to it. There's a lot of, you know, made up scripted stuff on that show, but the truth is addiction is, it's a horrible condition. It's one of the most underreported causes of death in our country. Mm. And the COVID is going to make that much worse, by the way, when the stats come out because of the isolation, because of shutting down 12-step meetings, not because of the quality of the work of 12 steps, but because of the connection of the people. You weren't allowed to get together. And so I'm a big advocate of fellowship, friendship, groups, families coming together and accepting people where they're at. You can do that and not enabling their addiction. You can still love your addict. And then that gets you a much better chance as a collaborative team, getting some real help versus, you know, getting somebody that again, the threat of isolation, you will lose everything unless you go do this. Well, they're going to go do it and they're going to be pissed off for the whole 30 days they're in treatment.
Right. Yeah, and that's definitely, I mean, how can you possibly conclude that that's going to produce a useful, progressive, helpful, positive result? I don't see how that can possibly happen. So glad to hear that you're on that track.
Yeah. And one caveat to that, I do want to say we're talking generality. There are people, I have met people that are on, you know, gram of fentanyl injected daily, which could kill you any day. So, mm-hmm. you know, so at some point there can be a real high level where you have to almost get somebody protected because tomorrow may be the day they die. So there are, you know, you got to do what's necessary to you know, for some of those cases. So, but I'm talking about general, 95% of the cases, if it's handled differently than this big dramatic event where your grandmother's sitting there crying, reading you a letter, how, you know, she loves you, but will have to cut you off if you don't go to treatment. I just find that fascinating that anybody believe that's effective for long-term recovery.
What you're saying makes total sense. I mean, if you were walking with your child on the street and the child tried to run out in traffic, you wouldn't try to set up a program to teach the child about not running into traffic. You'd grab the child, pull him back to the curb, save his life, and then you do a program that teaches them not to run off the curb. But you don't do it in the midst of their about to be killed situation. You don't do that. Yeah. That doesn't make any sense.
But it's like so many things. There's a whole, and we could do entire shows on how all the stuff for addiction came into place. You know, the treatment industry is a very profitable industry.
And when
I find it ironic that the main number one source of aftercare of very expensive treatment is totally free 12-step meetings. So it isn't that they find them that helpful. It's just they're free. So let's pay $50,000 to go get treatment, and then we're going to say your follow-up care is to go to these meetings that are free. It's like, that sounds more like an economical choice than a quality effort choice.
Yeah. This is all very fascinating. I'm particularly interested that, first of all, you saw that same TED talk that I saw. Boy, my lips aren't working. And that you were on the same wavelength as what this guy was saying. Cause I mean, he's completely self-taught. He didn't have any kind of training like you've had. You know, he didn't have any of that background and he came to that conclusion and you're coming to that same conclusion. So that's really interesting. I'm going to find a way to incorporate that into my talk. But this has been good. This has been really good. Thank you very much. I mean, first of all, I love the fact that we're reconnecting. I mean,
absolutely.
We're talking about social connections. You're one of my favorite social connections. And well, thank you. That's the way it is.
Yeah, it's something that we need to do this once a month or something. We need to figure out how to do that. I would love to get back into, you know, just making this. I can't do it weekly, but once a month. One of the things that has happened during, I never have quit seeing people in person, during COVID, and I'm really over capacity, as you can imagine, just trying to help anyone that I can possibly help with this. And, so things are slowing down a little bit in a very healthy way in my world. So I'm excited. I'm really excited. About your new speaker career. I can't wait to see where this goes. That's going to be excellent.
Me too. I don't know where it's going to go, but it's going to be interesting to see what happens with it. That's for sure. Yeah. I'm really interested to see too. I mean, I'm more interested than anybody else because I'm trying to plan it out like I would always do in the past. Right. But
right.
I'm now at the point where I don't know what's going to happen. You know, I've done all the setup that I can do. Now it's just get the word out there and see what fish bite. And I don't know what's going to happen. I have no idea. I mean,
one of the things, of course, I don't do anything traditional, but in the beginning, when I was doing, I would reach out to like local clubs, anybody.
Mm-hmm.
In the beginning, I didn't do paid. I just, let me talk. Let me hone my skills.
Right.
And the first paid talk I got, there was actually a member of the group I was talking to that owned a business that asked me to talk to his business. So, you know, it's a lot of different ways to do it. But just the main part is, as I do with anything, just do something, take action, move. And you're doing that. I like that.
I like it too. Yeah. And you were one of my mentors to drive me that way. So thank you very much. I appreciate that.
You're very welcome. It's great to see you.
Just a reminder to everybody, make sure that you've downloaded the LOA Today app. I don't know if you know that, Joel. We got an LOA Today app now they can listen to the podcast on.
I have it on my phone.
You do? Cool. All right. And the main reason I'm mentioning it is make sure you use the ask a question form to send in questions and comments because we like to include them here on the show. And we do that on most days, although on the days when I visit with Joel, I really don't want to do that. But most times we do. So take advantage and do that. We really appreciate you sending it in. And I appreciate you being here. So thank you very much for taking the time to do it, Joel. I really appreciate it.
It's so good. And again, to our audience, I those that have heard me before, thank you for listening again. And the new people, this is one of my favorite favorite projects, and I'm so glad to be able to do it, and I'm grateful for today. Thank you.
Glad to have you back, too. And thank you to all of our listeners. Without you, we wouldn't have a podcast. We'll see you all next time here on LOA Today. Goodbye, everybody.